Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and tonight I'm delighted to say we have another author entering the centre circle with us. But before we get to this evening's guest and their new book, I would like to introduce my regular compadres on such an occasion. So first of all, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you, sir?
Oh, very well, Stu, very well. How's it going your end?
Yeah. Not too bad, not too bad without boring everyone. It's coming towards the end of the academic year, so life is crazy, work is crazy, yep. But at some point a long summer holiday awaits.
Excellent.
So yeah, other than that, that's me. And also Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, how are you?
I'm good, Stu. Evening to you and Stephen, our guest. I'm really looking forward to this one. The book was a fantastic read, so I'm looking forward to talking through the contents with our guest tonight.
It is. You are right, and we will talk about the book, I promise. I promise we'll get to the book, because that's where everyone's interested. But before that, I do need to ask, how hot actually is it where you are in Spain?
It is really hot. It's currently over here, it's 9:05, and I'm sitting in shorts with the windows open and the aircon on full blast. I went to some shopping about, I don't know, 6:30 or so, and it was 34 degrees, so it's pretty warm, but, you know, I'm not complaining. That's one of the reasons I came out here, so yeah, all is good, all is good. Muy bien.
Oh, wow, you're like a native.
Mucho calor.
Okay, brilliant. Well, oh, sorry about that. Okay, well, onto tonight's guest, I guess, and then and the reason why we're here tonight. So tonight we have another author and journalist who's written for an array of high profile outlets, including The Independent and 442. Now branching out with his first book, has taken on the fascinating subject of the fallen stars of football, those who've been tipped for greatness only to drift away. Tonight, we're going to talk to Ryan Baldy about his wonderful new book, The Next Big Thing. Ryan, hello and welcome.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Like Gary said, really looking forward to it. Thought the book was great. You know, some wonderful, wonderful stories in it, if not some slightly tragic stories, but stories nonetheless, and wonderfully told. Before you start to talk to us about your book again, you know, I'd just like to say that hopefully once the listener have listened to this, I really do stress that they go out and purchase this book. Hopefully tonight we'll cover quite a bit of it, but it's certainly a book that requires reading from cover to cover. Like I say, mainly for all the different stories that are in there. I think they're just as important actually as sort of the tried and tested stories of, you know, professionals who've had a long career and a successful career. I think these stories are just as important.
Yeah, thank you. That's very, very kind of you to say. It was kind of, I guess, a bit of a passion project for me. I think, like most football fans, the emergence of a gifted young footballer is always something that really kind of sparks the imagination. And it's something to cling to for fans of that club. But when things don't quite go the way you're expecting for that player, and they fade from view. I think once they faded from view, they're kind of forgotten quite quickly. You see them appear in these listicles online of the 10 wonder kids who never made it. But I think it's never quite understood fully why that can happen, how that can happen, and what comes next. So that's kind of the idea that I wanted to explore with the book.
So, for people who are listening, you know, it might be sort of the first time they've heard of this book, but just give us an overview of, I suppose, the book content, you know, how you lay it out, and then, you know, like you say, a little bit more about the rationale for writing it.
Yeah, so I've used interviews with 15 players. I reached out to, my list was probably 50 or 60 long of players who were all suitable for this book, so it's in no way a kind of definitive list of fallen quote-unquote wonder kids, but these are the people who were willing and prepared to share their story with me. So I went out and met these footballers There's quite a broad range of ages and eras that they played in, dating from sort of the mid-80s with the subject of Chapter One, who's Ali Dick, who played for Spurs and Ajax, all the way through to guys like Adam Morgan and John Bostock, who are still playing and still in their mid-20s, and everything in between. So, yeah, there are 15 players, all have their own dedicated chapter. So I went out to them, spoke to them, met them, understood them, learned their story, put it across kind of in their own words, but also with background filled in by my own research and by speaking to people who've worked with them. So there's contributions from either journalists who've covered their careers, teammates they've played with, coaches they've worked with. In some instances, there are directors of football who signed them for the club that they never quite made the grade at. And it's just to try and paint as fair and as clear a picture as possible of each player's story and do them justice, to kind of fill in the blanks that I think a lot of football fans will have their memories. I think there'll be a lot of names here that people will recognise, but perhaps the full stories aren't understood as well as they deserve to be. And then in the process of doing that, it kind of became an exploration of all the different ways that a young footballer can be tripped up along the way, or all the ways that the football dream can be denied of a young man, and what comes next after that. So in a sense, each chapter, each player that I spoke to and their story became a kind of case study into a different way that things can go awry for a young football player.
I am gonna get Gary and Stephen in a minute, I promise, guys. I won't leave you out there. But just something you've just said there, Ryan, do you see, I'm not saying you see yourself as this, but is it almost being an advocate for these players and their stories and the importance to tell their story?
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted them to feel like I've done their story justice, like they've had a fair picture painted of them, because I think it's often the case that you know, the highs are put across and then they're kind of branded as a failure of some sort, when more often than not it's factors beyond their control which have kind of sort of snatched that dream away from them. So I just wanted it to be as fair as possible to these people. It's not sugarcoated. I try and show them warts and all, but I also try and put them across in as much of a human light. It sounds a bit pretentious maybe, but it's not so much a book about football. You know, the actual action on the pitch is only a small part of what I was exploring here. It's about what happens to these young men in this chosen profession, which promises riches and fame and glory and all of that at the beginning, for that then to be stripped away, often, like I said, from factors beyond their control. You know, how a person deals with that and how they rebuild themselves afterwards, and that's kind of the overriding theme.
It's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, Gary, you know, like I say, we were all lucky enough to be sent a copy of the book. You know, your overview, your initial thoughts of the book, having read it.
I guess probably the first thing I'd say is that Ryan writes with a great deal of empathy for the guys that the subject of the book, and each of them have their own story, and some have bad luck and some are through injury and some made mistakes along the way. But, you know, there's none of the people that Ryan talks about who you'd say, well, you know, you deserve to fail because, you did something particularly wrong, you messed your chance up through ill discipline and bad behaviour. They were just, I guess we forget that young footballers, just come the end of the day, they're just young people as well. And they're prey to temptations and perils that all youngsters have. And there's a lot of these guys who you feel a lot of empathy for. And that's very much a credit to the way Ryan's wrote about them.
It's a very empathetic perspective, Guy. You're absolutely right. Yourself, Stephen, I mean, you know, your thoughts, your initial feelings on the subject matter and the way it's been dealt with.
Yeah, I agree with Ryan. It's one of those books that's not first and foremost about the football. It's the humanity. You know, it's the personalities behind the people involved. You know, football is just the backdrop here. You know, it's very much like in the same kind of theme as State of Play, which, you know, we were lucky enough to speak to Michael Calvin. You know, and it's getting to see behind the facade of the footballer, and, you know, the intricacies of why things did not work out for them. And I thought it was a you know, a fantastic read, and it's brilliant on how you know, you get to kind of like travel along those fine lines of success and failure with each player. And an outstanding book. And it's one of those brilliant books where you don't have to be a football fan to read it and get it.
No, you're absolutely right. And you're right. It's a great study and story, like you say, a story of 15 stories of humanity, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. If you were, have any interest in kind of like human nature and success and failure of an endeavour, and no matter what that is, and it happens to be football with this book, you will get a lot out of it.
Ryan, well, Stephen's touched on a great point there, and I'm sure we'll come to it, as we chat and go through. But with right at the beginning, you sort of mentioned that it's certainly not an exhaustive list of players, and I was just wondering how you selected the players that ended up in the book, whether it was by the ones where you had most access to people who knew them, whether you thought that their stories were the most interesting or the most important to tell. I was just wondering how you shortlisted your players.
Yeah, as I mentioned, it was quite a long list I had of players who would fit the mould of what I was looking for. Some fit more snugly than others for it. I just reached out to them any way I could. The old kind of journalistic instinct kicks in of how you can try and wrangle your way to get an access when it's increasingly difficult. It was different. It was a case-by-case kind of thing. Sometimes I knew people who knew people who knew people kind of thing, and you follow that kind of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon or whatever the old saying is. Sometimes it's a case of reaching out to clubs or people who've worked with them and just seeing if they can put me in contact. Sometimes Twitter was a great resource as well, to message these people. But a lot of the guys weren't either willing or kind of maybe not in a position or maybe not ready to kind of to tell their story, to think of themselves as a kind of... I guess with a lot of the guys, I know there are a couple who are still playing and still working towards getting back to where they hope they would be. But for a lot of guys, they've got a kind of... This kind of thing requires seeing you and your football career as a closed book, almost as a story that's complete and to look back on. And that, I think, that demands that you get to a certain place within yourself, which I don't think everyone who has gone through the kind of things these players have gone through has reached. So first and foremost, these were the guys who were open enough, willing to share their story with me, and kind of been able to put things in a healthy perspective, which, considering what some of them went through, they weren't always that way. It took a while to get there. There were some struggles along the way, but I was just very fortunate to reach out to people who are very kind and in a position now where they do feel like they can reflect on it as kind of a positive, as something to be for lessons to be gleaned from, even for themselves or from others.
It's funny. I think it was Stephen who mentioned Michael Calvin, and we mentioned some of the stories, the human stories that take place in his State of Play book. And I suppose there's a great deal of trust, I suppose, from these players. I mean, essentially, they're trusting you with their story, which, as you've said, can be quite painful and quite raw and relatively recent. For some of them. So, I suppose it's a massive responsibility on your part to get it right, if you like, or certainly in a way that, like you say, tells the story, because it's important to tell the whole story and not to sugarcoat it, but also to do it in a responsible manner that the player feels like that you've done their story, or that you've done right by them with telling their story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I felt the weight of that throughout the writing process and the kind of the butterflies in the stomach moment that when it's sent to press and it's there and it's going to be out there, that these players who've been so generous and so kind with me to share their stories, that hopefully I've done them justice, not just to the wider world, but more specifically to them, that they're happy to have out there what I'm putting out there, and that they feel it is a fair reflection of what we spoke about and of their lives and their careers. It's quite a big thing. These are people's lives that I'm trying to put across and detail. I definitely felt that responsibility. I didn't want to sort of sugarcoat things or make it too much of a rose-tinted view of their career. But like you mentioned, I was trying to be empathetic throughout, while also being fair to their story and fair to them. And luckily, from the guys I've heard back from so far, they're quite pleased with how it's come across. And that was a bit of a relief in some ways that they felt that way. And it also, yeah, it made me feel like that was kind of my main job here, was that, rather than to make it especially exciting or enticing to the reader, that these guys felt that they'd been done justice and been given a fair chance to tell their story.
That's brilliant. I mean, Gary, it's strange, isn't it? Because you know, you can have, you know, the stories about George Best, Paul Gascoigne, that there are players who really reached the highs and achieved success and then crashed and burned, for want of, I'm sure Ryan can put it in a better way than that, but you get the gist. But these stories seem so, you know, they're so much more fragile, or the characters in these stories seem so much more fragile than those players, even though, you know, the George Best, the Paul Gascoigne, you know, and we can list some that fall into that category, you know, theirs seem almost catastrophic at the time because of high profile media, etc. But the stories that Ryan's talking about seem really fragile and, you know, and almost, you know, breakable, aren't they?
Yeah, it's true. The sort of consistent feel I got from the one of the guys that Ryan featured was that there was a perhaps not understandable lack of bitterness, because, you know, any football fan, and we're all football fans, you know, but, you know, it's like Bobby Robson said, I'd give my right arm to be a concert pianist. Well, you know, we give our right leg to be a footballer, but, you know, to have that chance of playing for one of the top clubs in the country, you know, beat Man United, Liverpool, Tottenham, Chelsea, Arsenal, whoever, and then, you know, to be lauded and have this opportunity, and then to fall away, oftentimes for things that weren't your fault, and it beat injuries or clash of personality with a coach, or just bad luck, or another guy came through and took your position and you couldn't get into the first team. And a lot of people would imagine would feel bitter about it, but there seems almost a total absence of that bitterness. That people also almost feel, well, you know, I had my chance, it didn't work out, but, you know, I'm getting on with my life. And there's other players who were, I mean, like John Bostock, who was still playing, but a lot of the players that Ryan featured in the book are now away from the game. And as I said, the abiding impression I got was the, you know, almost maturity of it, and there was a lack of bitterness and acceptance that, you know, sometimes things just didn't work out, but that's another phase of my life. Turn the page onto a new chapter.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You know, it's like you say, it's almost that not all beyond the years, but what they've been through seems to have been such a, and Ryan will know better than us, but it seems to be such a steep growing up curve. They've almost grown up before, you know, like you mentioned, Gary, there are young boys, young men going into an adult occupation, but yet these players seem to have grown up particularly quickly because of what they've had to face and go through.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, Stephen, it's, you know, these stories are just as important in terms of, like, you know, we've talked about being a human story and football as the backdrop, but these stories are just as important as the George Bests and the Paul Gascoignes and the so on.
Well, they are, because these are the players that got that massive weight on their shoulders of being rated or judged or expected to be the next George Best and the next Paul Gascoigne. You know, yes, Paul Gascoigne and George Best had their own defined, you know, career paths that arced up and then crashed down. But, you know, they were somehow different in that they did reach the stars in some kind of manner. The star shone brightly for a short period of time, but it did shine. These players that came later on were judged by those talents. You know, they were seen as young, precocious players, and they were given a badge to wear to say, you will be the next George Best, you will be the next Paul Gascoigne. And that's just an absolutely unenviable position for a player, a young player, to be in, and then not to be able to attain that. You know, that there is, and I think that was the great word that you used there, was this fragility, and that's exactly what it is. It's just this epic fragility of these players.
Do you think, Stephen, that comes from football? as an entity? Do you think it comes from fans? Do you think it comes from, like you say, the weight of history or the desperation for success? I mean, where does that pressure, where does it really come from?
I think it comes from it's a combination of things, but primarily it tends to be driven by the press. You know, the player will be picked up. It's slightly different now because the foreign transfer market has opened it up so much more, and you know, perhaps younger players don't have that expectation put upon them in that manner. But the pressure's greater. You know, the greater overall pressure is massive now. You don't hear of players coming along now and saying that, you know, this is the next George Best, this is the next, you know, Ryan Giggs. You don't really hear that so much about British players because they've somehow been sidelined. There's still much expected of them. They get, you know, they earn a huge amount of money at a very young age. And then, you know, if they don't make it, then what becomes of them? But these were the players before the wages went stratospheric. These are the players, many of them, that are part of the book, were part of an era where, you know, foreign players were still a minority in the English game. They were a rarity. Most clubs had 7, 8, 9 British players and then like a small smattering of foreign players. So that concept of the player coming through was quite massive. So that expectation would rise from the press, but then the fans would catch on to it. And because I can remember at Liverpool where, you know, Robbie Fowler came through, and then every bright young star in the youth team that scored 20 goals at under 15 level was expected to be the next Robbie Fowler. And this carried on until maybe the turn of the millennium when Gerard Houllier comes along and you know, more established foreign players start to arrive, and that fixation starts to fade away. But yeah, it becomes a collective thing, and then the player themselves puts the pressure on themselves to live up to this billing that they've been given.
Yeah, just jump in there, Stu. I mean, it's perhaps worth mentioning that, you know, this is, you know, and Steve is absolutely right, you know, the pressure to be the next George Best and that sort of thing, this isn't a new thing. You know, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when William Morgan was signed by Man United from Burnley as the next George Best. It was the next George Best. That was the plan. And although this guy played, I don't know, perhaps 250 games for Man United, he never hit that great height, but he still carried that pressure. And I read his autobiography a while ago.
Sammy McElroy was another one. You know,
But
they are automatically given this you know, impossible dream to live up to.
Yeah, but it's also true across geography as well. I mean, just a couple of Barcelona players that come to mind, Bojan and Dos Santos. It's the next big guy. Freddie Adu in America.
Yeah, it's by no means a British thing. You know, yeah. Sergio Canal is another one.
Absolutely,
you know, so much expected of him. And not to be able to fulfil that potential, but still to motor along and have a reasonable career. Yeah. You know, there's that sense of unfulfilled, you know, destiny. It's not even potential. It's like a destiny unfulfilled.
Yeah, I mean, the guys just mentioned, I mean, you know, Freddie Adu, Bojan, Dos Santos plays in MLS at the moment, and, you know, and anybody looking at it from an objective point of view would say, that's a pretty damn good career. But because of the hype they had and the pressure before, he's perceived as being a failure. And I think this is something that that Ryan brings out really well in the book, that the pressure these guys were under to be something that perhaps they could have been but actually couldn't deliver on for a variety of reasons, doesn't detract from the fact that they were still damn decent players and could have had a decent career, but was perhaps blighted by the pressure they were under.
It's funny. I mean, you're right, Gary. I was going to ask Ryan in terms of common denominators. You know, with everybody that he, certainly with the players that he met and the players that he's spoken to, whether that pressure was a common denominator amongst most. Whether they felt that the pressure came from a particular area. You know, as we've just chatted, you know, Stephen's just mentioned, you know, a lot of it comes from the media. Then from there, it goes to the fans, and it sort of transmits itself as a name starts to become known, sort of locally, then nationally. And I suppose, Ryan, you know, in terms of common denominators and common factors with regards to this intolerable pressure, you know, did you find that there was a common thread that ran through all of these players?
I think it was there for all of them. I think it's interesting. Some of the guys you mentioned there. people like George Best and Paul Gascoigne are obvious kind of touchstones for such a subject as this, because they were so good and their fall from grace was so great. I think what's different for people like that is that they were geniuses. They were generational talents. They were once in a generation players. The guys I spoke to were all very, very good footballers, but they weren't geniuses. They never had... I think there's always that's kind of a redeeming quality that a George Best or a Gascoigne will have, is that no matter what they go through off the field, their natural gifts are to such a level that they're always going to be able to produce the goods, even if it's not as consistently as they should or could do if they were living the perfect life. But I think there's always going to be that level of interest and intrigue and a belief in them, because they do have that spark of genius. These guys who I spoke to, I think, were forgotten more quickly because that wasn't true of them, in a sense, because they were very, very good footballers, but they were never going to be the next Messi or the next Ronaldo. They were going to be, you know, a hero to their club, perhaps. But whatever reason, it didn't work out, and then people are on to the next one. So it's almost like the moment the pressure and the attention disappears is the common thread that some found hard to deal with, and kind of that's where reality bites, when people stop talking about you rather than when people are talking about you and building you up, if that makes any sense. So the pressure is there from the offset, and I think that's kind of more often than not that these players are expecting that and are ready for that and are enjoying that. It's when that spotlight is switched off or is switched to someone else, particularly which is relevant to the Ben Thorney chapter in the book, with the whole class of 92 thing at Man United, when it's switched to your peers. So coming through at 18, 19, you're regarded to be, if not the best, then it's certainly one of the best two or three of this generation of players, destined for absolutely everything at one of the biggest clubs in the world. Injury robs it from you. But while you're out recuperating in a dingy gym at the training ground, your four or five best friends are all going on and living that dream that you wanted to live with them. And you're kind of forgotten about. So guys like Beckham and their Scholes and the Nevilles would have gone on and continued to perform under that pressure, under that spotlight. But that spotlight was completely kind of robbed and switched off from Ben Thornley in that sense. So it's almost kind of like a reverse of the way it's sometimes viewed, that the pressure builds them up and then breaks them down. I guess it's when that rug is pulled from underneath them and how they react to that and how they deal with that and how things, you know, the domino effect that can set off. That's pretty much the point at which these guys, the stories of these players become linked, essentially, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
You're right. I mean, it's fascinating. Just listening to you there, you know, it's absolutely fascinating. You know, that perspective of, you know, we think, you know, as an outsider looking in, that it's the pressure that gets them, or the pressure that causes the breaking points, or the pressure that leads to that's too much to cope with. And actually, they actually miss the pressure. The pressure is almost what they thrive on. The pressure is what keeps them, gives them their edge. And then, like you say, when that pressure is removed due to injury or whatever the circumstance is, that's when it starts to go wrong, which is not, certainly for myself, is not a perspective that sometimes, you know, comes to mind straight away.
Yeah, I think, if anything, kind of boredom was more of a factor that the guys spoke about than the pressure. Dealing with those days in the gym where you're recuperating or those days where you can't go and play, or when, for whatever reason, you might be able to play part-time, you've dropped down a level, or you're not in the team, you're falling out with the manager, you're not being selected. How do you fill those hours that football's all you've ever known? And what do you do to kind of to replace that, or how do you... What can you do to maintain focus? What help do you need? What help were you given? What help wasn't there for you? That's where a lot of the downward spirals can stem from.
It's funny. I was going to ask you actually with regards to sort of the psychology and personality element of this. Again, I know I seem to keep asking the same question. I apologise, but in terms of common denominators and common factors, personality-wise, did you get an impression that these players mentally we're all very, very similar in terms of characteristics and personality, or was it, you know, purely random? So, you know, one player's personality's strengths was another player's weakness and so on. Or is there a psychological thread that maybe runs through this?
Yeah, that's an interesting point to kind of consider. I would say that there wasn't. They're all different people, or just like the four of us will be here. They all have their different strengths and weaknesses. But you use the word random there. I think that's kind of the point of what I was trying to get to. Also, you guys were talking about the fragility of it. That's what I was trying to explore. The way I've described it, the tagline I use whenever I'm trying to promote a book on Twitter or whatever, is that it's lessons in the fragility of the football dream. And I think we don't really like to consider football as being a game beholden to randomness too much. We like to think that everything happens for a reason, that a result is a direct result of tactics or of effort or of skill. When sometimes things just happen, the ball bounces a certain way, a player gets injured at a certain time, or all these kind of things can affect outcomes. And it's no different to an individual's career as well. So I don't think there is any kind of common theme of perhaps a psychological weakness or some sort of deficiency in mentality. I think more often than not, to get to where they got to, which was a higher level than probably 99% of people who start the game will ever get to, it requires jumping through so many hoops and passing so many different selection processes just to get to the precipice of top level football, that I think any kind of mental fragility has already been weeded out. So yeah, that would be my answer to that one, is that they're all very different. It's just they were all kind of hostages to fortune.
It's. I mean, Gary, do you, you know, obviously based on what, you know, what Ryan's just said, and certainly, you know, you guys have mentioned that you've got to look at the generational element of the players in Ryan's book. But do you, sort of bringing it up to date, do you see football, certainly at this young, at this early stage, so if we look from the sort of 16s to maybe 20-year-olds, do you see football doing more to protect players? And I don't mean, you know, like you say, they make an awful lot of money now, and you know, you like to think that football clubs are better prepared, but are football clubs doing enough to protect players who maybe do go through this?
I guess the short answer is you probably can never do enough, and they're probably doing more, but whether that's enough is perhaps a point of conjecture. It's a difficult thing because you know, when somebody dangles a potential, you know, career where you're going to earn vast amounts of money and be acclaimed by your peers and you know, and fans as some kind of superstar and a hero for your local club, it's very easy to be seduced into the belief that this could be, you know, this is life, this is how it's going to be. But for, you know, I don't know what the percentage of players who don't make it from academies who were once deemed to be a star player. I'm just mentioning, I'm researching a piece about a guy called Dale Jennings at the moment, who was a star at Liverpool, was released and went to Tranmere. And then at 18, he got a transfer to Bayern Munich and was at Bayern Munich. And I think he was there for 18 months, and due to injuries and various other things, never actually got into the first team. And he ended up playing at a couple of other things happened in his life, but it's just he ended up playing at Runcorn Town. And so many players must have a similar sort of story to that, where they had this sort of this fantastic dream dangled from them, only to be snatched away. And only and I use the word fortunate advisedly. It's not necessarily the best, but and I think Ryan made a point here, the way the ball bounces sometimes makes a difference. And, you know, you get a lucky break or you don't get a lucky break. You get a chance to play in the first team because a guy gets injured, you take your chance, or you don't because the guy doesn't get injured. On such small things do careers turn, and you haven't got to be the best player, you haven't got to be the worst player for it to happen to you one way or the other. And it's almost like a lottery. And of all the players that fall by the wayside, how many would say they were treated exceptionally well by the clubs and looked after? I would say probably a minority would say that, but it's difficult to say. I have no first-hand knowledge of that, but that's a feeling I get anyway.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it is, a lot of it is conjecture. You know, unfortunately, we're not lucky enough to know the inner workings of professional football clubs. But I mean, you know, with regards to you, Stephen, you know, Gary's just made a great point there about it. It's almost pure luck, isn't it? It's almost pure chance. You know, they say talent will eventually find its level, and you know, if you're good enough, you'll reach level. But actually, there is such an element of fortune in a player's career.
Well, there is, because you know, football's a game of risk. When push comes to shove, you know, any player who you know, strides over that white line for a start of football match, there's no saying that they won't be carried off on a stretcher. You know, at the end of it, or the match ends on the back of a stretcher. You know, so many players have seen a career ended by a mistimed challenge, you know, absolutely anything. So there is just this utter random lottery to it sometimes, you know, and it's, you know, fate's a big word, but you know, some players are just fated not to reach where they're meant to be, or you know, they do reach where they're meant to be in a way, but you know, the potential that they had and the trajectory that we all think that they should follow. You know, there was a player at Liverpool in the 1980s called Wayne Harrison, who was just the most cursed player I've ever known. You know, he died a few years ago, and I don't think he was even 40. And but he was bought from Oldham for, you know, a huge amount for a teenage player at the time. You know, he was highly, highly rated. You know, he had that moniker of being the next Kenny Dalglish or the next Ian Rush. You know, his style of play was more towards the Ian Rush than it was the Kenny Dalglish. But he was a player of rich potential who should have made the first team. But, you know, a succession of devastating injuries eventually ended his career. And yeah, it is. It doesn't matter what talent you have. You know, if it's not meant to be, it's just not meant to be.
It's funny, Ryan. I shouldn't have long periods of silence because I just think random thoughts while everyone else is speaking. But Gary's just mentioned. I'm sorry, Gary. What did you say the name of the player was that you were researching at the moment?
It's Dale Jennings, wasn't it?
Dale Jennings. So. Yeah. I'm interested to know, with, you know, obviously, you know, Gary mentioned they went to Bayern Munich, but what I'm trying to get at, you know, the first player that you talk about in your book is Ali Dick. Now, he eventually went to work under Johan Cruyff. Now, there's a lot of players, as to quote Gary, would give the right leg to play under Johan Cruyff. Is there almost a contentment within some of these players with what they did achieve? I mean, there's a lot of players who never worked with Johan Cruyff. So, did you find that satisfaction was gained from some of the players based purely on the experience that they did manage to achieve within their career?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, that's definitely something that came across with a lot of guys, particularly the older guys who their careers may be a little bit further back in their rearview mirror now. Again, Dale Jennings is somebody who was on my list, who I tried to reach out to. Wayne Harrison, as Stephen mentioned, he was someone, of course, who's not around anymore, whose story I considered telling, but I wanted to base all of these around kind of first-hand interviews as much as I could. And Billy Kenny is another one who was at Everton, who's in a similar vein. He was another one who's on my list. So, yeah, as we mentioned before, there were so many of these stories that hopefully through the 15 that I managed to kind of get access to and to tell in the book, you can kind of get a bit of a better understanding and appreciation of all those ones that have gone before and will come after. But yeah, there's definitely kind of a perspective gained. I think that's perhaps a result of the players that I spoke to being the ones who were willing to speak to me, the ones who were in that place, who have reached that level of looking back on their career and thinking, do you know what? I might not have got to where people thought I was going to get or where I wanted to get, but I certainly got pretty damn far. So guys, you know, guys like you said, Ali Dick worked with Cruyff. I really enjoyed just chatting to Ali about working under Cruyff and playing at Ajax and playing with, you know, feeding balls through to Ronald Koeman when he didn't know who he was, playing alongside Frank Rijkaard and Marco van Basten and players like that. A lot of that stuff that would have been on the cutting room floor, but I was just geeking out on my own there to learn about all these things.
I fully get that.
And you got Ben Thorney, who played at Man United and in some great teams there, under Sir Alex Ferguson, Fabio da Silva, who's one of the more recent chapters in the book towards the back end, one of the the younger players who's still playing now. He started a Champions League final. Not too many people can say that. So even though things didn't quite go to plan for him at Man United, the interesting thing about his chapter, from my point of view, was that he was always considered the better of the two Da Silva twins, but his brother went on to play 150 or something games for United, whereas he maybe played 30 or so. So that's kind of what I wanted to explore there. But when you do look back, and he still got there, he still played for Man United. He got out of Brazil and made a career for himself in Europe, played in the Champions League final, as I said. With a lot of these guys, I think more often than not, they reached the first team level of a top flight club at a really young age, which is something I think that most of them, if they don't already, then they certainly will come to look back on and think that's something not too many people can say. And there's a contentment to that for sure.
I'm glad you've said that. I mean, it's funny, isn't it, Gary? I mean, like you say, we're all football fans, and you have, we have these stories of these players, and the initial thought is one of almost sorrow or remorse for them, and yet actually, you have Ali Dick, who's learnt under Johan Cruyff, and alongside Marco van Basten, you've got Ben Thornley, who will always be able to talk about when he played with Beckham and Scholes and Butt and the Nevilles, and worked under Alex Ferguson. These are things that, and I suppose Ryan's nerded out on that we could talk about, and would even just to spend a day or a week with some of these people. These are sorrowful tales, but not completely sorrowful, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely right. One of the chapters in Ryan's book that sort of resonated with me was Matt Murray, because when I used to live in the UK, Matt Murray came from Lichfield, which was about, 10 minutes away from where I used to live. And because he played for Wolves, my wife's a Wolves fan, and she always remembers the end, and there's a picture on our wall with her parents going to watch the playoff when they beat Sheffield United to get promoted, and Murray put in a man of the match performance, even though his team won 3-0, saving a penalty. But the better save was when Paul Ince misdirected a header and he kept it out. So I mean, Matt Murray was an exceptionally young goalkeeper, and he was a guy who I could have gone on to play for England many, many times. And it's interesting that when I was reading the chapter about Murray, that when he was younger, he was quite small and was considered quite frail. And he's a giant of a man now. And he would have been an imposing goalkeeper, but was robbed by injury. And yet here's a guy who's made a success of an alternative career in TVs, quite often on Sky Sports and other punditry situations, and I think it's almost an uplifting thing to see that a lot of these players aren't bitter, and somebody like Matt Murray then went on to forge another career as well. So there is a positive side to getting to that stage that these guys got to, and then looking, where do I go next? But as I said earlier, turn the page, what's the next chapter in my life?
It's funny. I want to come on to that in a minute or so about, with regards to sort of the success stories and what these players go on to do after the football career has finished. But I think before, like I said, I have too much thinking time. Before I do that, I just wanted to ask Stephen, especially as a Liverpool fan, do you think there is, when you have such history and tradition of great, great, great players, as Ryan mentioned, the Gascoigne and the George Best, were absolute genius. And if you look at Liverpool now, you're a Liverpool fan. I would imagine the next young midfielder that's going to come through is going to be compared to Steven Gerrard, let's say, until the next Steven Gerrard arrives. Do you think players who are at this type of club will suffer more than, say, someone from Hull City, where you could be the next anyone, really? There isn't these icons of the game. I'm just, with being a Liverpool fan, do you think there is more pressure on players coming through at your club than, say, my club?
There probably is, and that's just kind of like the level that you can look at, say, Harry Wilson at the minute. He's absolutely tore the Championship up last season with Derby County, a team that could easily, actually came quite close to promotion to the Premier League. And yeah, he's completely unlikely to make it at Anfield, no matter how.
I think he was at Hull, wasn't he?
He was. I'm getting my Liverpool players the wrong way.
No, that's fine. I'm sure he was at Hull, not last season, the season before. But that's right.
The season before,
he is outstanding.
Yeah, and that's it. He's a fine player. Yeah, you're going to need that little bit extra. You are going to have to be a carbon copy of a Steven Gerrard or a Steve McManaman or a Robbie Fowler or a Michael Owen to make it at Anfield. And it's such a shame, really. But this is where kind of you get the likes of Jadon Sancho, who are going to the Bundesliga to try the look overseas. And I think more English players need to do that. Because certainly the top four, five, six teams, you just don't have that elbow space to be able to come through and to have the chance to blossom, really. That is on a level playing field, fully fit, having no fitness problems, no serious injuries, and that's just playing on a weekly basis.
When you met these players, you know, and you spoke to them, and you obviously, you know, spent a lot of time with them, were there moments where they could pinpoint a definitive moment where this was not going to work, and I suppose like a sliding doors moment is what I'm asking, with Stephen talking about Jadon Sancho moving across to Germany, you know, did you find many, I suppose, sliding door moments where they thought that was the time I should have made this decision, or I could have made this decision and it would have turned out differently?
Yeah, for some it was fairly apparent. Again, to go back to Ben Thornley, the injury he got in the reserve game a few weeks before he was due to play in the FA Cup semi-final at Wembley. He gave us a bad tackle in a reserve game from a frustrated veteran who's been given the runaround all game. And there goes his ACL, his MCL, his hamstring all in one go. And from there, even though medical science at that point had got to the point where he could recover a career from that kind of injury, whereas maybe 5-10 years earlier he wouldn't have been able to, he was never going to be the same. And I guess that, which you only have to partially know his story to know that was a turning point, that was a sliding doors moment. But the others, that was kind of what I saw as my task, in a way, to kind of pinpoint at what point things began to slide for them. And that, for example, the chapter on Andy van der Meijden, which is probably the most explosive in a way chapter in the book for all the things that he got up to throughout his life, which are interesting off the field, to say the least. But it was really interesting for me to kind of find out, to not just put across the fact that, yeah, okay, he had an alcohol problem, his womanizing led to the divorce and breakup of his family, that once he retired at Everton, he stayed in Liverpool for a year and was on a drink and cocaine binge, and, you know, thought, you know, I've got to get out of here, otherwise I'm going to die. That's all the sensational part of it. That's all in there. But I wanted to kind of figure out how he got there, how he got to that point, and where did it begin to turn for him. And from what I could gather from listening to his story, it was at the point when he was 23, when he was sold by Ajax without any prior knowledge. They just called him up to the technical director's office one day after training and said, congratulations, you're going to Inter. We've just sold you. And he had 24, 48 hours to negotiate personal terms, and he was off to Italy. He said it himself, he was kind of a homebody, never really wanted to leave Ajax. He was happy there, he was playing the best football of his career. Little did he know at the time, but that would be the best football he would ever play. He never got back to level. He got to Italy. Hector Cooper, the manager, the first thing he said to him when he met him, when Van der Meijden went over to shake his hand and introduce himself, Hector Cooper said, who the fuck are you? Because he wasn't signed by the manager. That's not the way things tend to work in Italy. All he did, he wanted wingers, so the sporting director gave him a winger. He didn't know who he was. And so from that point on, you know, he never managed to fully break into the team, never settled in Milan. And from there came the boredom when he wasn't playing, when he wasn't in the team, when he was getting injured, he was going out drinking, he was going out meeting women. He got the move to Everton on the back of a move to Monaco collapsing. So again, he was in a situation where he probably didn't really want to be, came over injured, and so it was playing catch-up from the start. And it just all goes back to that one sort of, like you said, a sliding doors moment where Ajax told him it was time to go when he wasn't ready to leave. So, yeah, some of them I had to do some kind of digging and investigating and pondering to figure out at what point things started to slide. Others, like the guys who had the catastrophic injuries, were more obvious. But it's also, Gary mentioned Matt Murray too, he is another one who is a tale of injury, like a Ben Thornley or like a few of the others in the book. But what's interesting about his particular story is that it was never so much one catastrophic injury. It was a series of injuries that were recoverable. They were serious, but they were recoverable. But they were relentless. They never stopped. So as soon as you get back to fitness, another one came. And he did speak about the moment he realized it was over, which I think is kind of where I opened with on a chapter on him. He had been sent out to Hereford, who were, I think, League One or Two at the time, to play a couple of games, get his fitness back up so he could go and challenge Michael Oakes for the number one shirt at Wolves. By this point, he was in his mid to late 20s. He's already well established as a goalkeeper of serious talent, but somebody who's got terrible luck with injuries. And it just happened again. His knee went, and he talked about being in the ambulance after the game and calling Robbie Keane, who they were close friends, having come through at Wolves together. And he was just in tears, saying to Robbie Keane, like, this is it. I don't think I can come back this time. It's too much. It's all gotten on top of me now. So, yeah, that was the moment. Sometimes there was a real sort of moment of clarity for the individual of realising that this is my sliding doors moment. This is the point at which there is no real return. For others, it's only with retrospect, looking back, that you realise at what point that came. But there was definitely, I think, for all 15 guys, or at least for the guys who aren't still playing, aren't still working to get back to where they were, there was a distinct point at which things turned for them.
Can I ask you a question, mate?
Yeah, Gary, go right ahead.
Thank you. I mean, it's something that when Stevie was talking about Harry Wilson and, you know, and his prospects of getting a first-team game at Liverpool are pretty remote. I'm sure that's true, especially with the players they have there. I mean, I'm a Chelsea fan, Ryan, and, you know, we had a fantastic academy, and I can't remember the figures precisely, but we won the FA Youth Cup 6 out of the last 8 years or something similar to that. Ridiculous amount of successful players and not actually had these players come through the first team. And the transfer ban we have now might be an absolute blessing in disguise, you know, to let some of these young players play. So did any of the players that you spoke to feel that they were their opportunities were limited because of imported players?
I don't think so. Not from memory. There were other factors, things like fallouts from managers and things like that limited their options. And Stefan Moore from Aston Villa was somebody who spoke about being one of six competing for a place at Villa. But I think he was more kind of grateful to be one of those six, to be 18 years old and in a position to go and fight for your place and prove
that
you're
better. Would he be the same time as Angel, Juan Pablo Angel? Was that
yeah, he'd just come in. I think they had Peter Crouch on the books at the time. It was that kind of era where they had five or six, the rights for sale would have still been there. So I think it was kind of, maybe at the time he might look back and think, yeah, if we didn't have so many foreign imports at the time, I would have got more of a chance. But at the same time, at that point when he was, you know, destroying veteran defenders in training day in, day out, he was backing himself to get in the team ahead of any of these players. So it wasn't so much a consideration of his at the time. But yeah, I do think, I'm sure it is a factor. It's obvious that fewer homegrown players are breaking through to the first team these days, but there's also the kind of counterpoint to that, that the foreign players who've come in have raised the level, so the ones who do break through are a better standard. So I guess it's a bit of a give and take there.
I was thinking about John Bostock, because wasn't he? He was from memory, serves me right, have to read the chapter on him. He was there with Martin Yol, correct, and Santini, and didn't
that was. Owen Price was there at the who's another subject of a chapter in the book. They were bringing in homegrown players at the time that clogged up his pathway to the first team. So Owen was he was signed from Charlton for Spurs about the age of, I think, 14 or 15 for a really big price tag, around £500,000 at the time.
That's right.
In the early 2000s. He was a standout in the youth team. Who broke his leg at 18. He'd been an England youth international and played alongside guys like Wayne Routledge and Aaron Lennon. And his account of those encounters with those players is that he was a better player than them at that age.
Yeah.
But Spurs went and signed Routledge from Crystal Palace, went and signed Lennon from Leeds, because I guess those guys have gone and got their opportunities at a club who weren't as high achieving as Spurs at that time. So they came with a bit more cachet, they came with a bit more of a reputation, whereas Owen was never really given the chance to establish himself at Spurs. But yeah, Bostock is another one who, he's an interesting case. He was signed by Damien Comoli, who I spoke to for the book. And at the time, Juan de Ramos was the manager when he was signed from Palace. It was a really controversial deal. He was only 16. He'd been, he's still the youngest ever player to play for Palace. He's the youngest ever player to play for Spurs as well. He actually beat Ali Dick's record. He still holds both those records as far as I'm aware. So he was signed by Spurs from Palace at 16 by Damien Comoli with Juan de Ramos in charge. But within weeks of him signing there, Ramos was sacked, Comoli was dispensed with, in came Harry Redknapp, and the whole development path that had been laid out for Bostock that he'd been sold on, the reason he joined Spurs in the first place, was completely forgotten about. So he ended up being kind of stuck in the reserves and sent on a series of ill-thought-out loans to clubs that didn't suit him. He was a central midfield playmaker. He was being forced to play on the right wing at Brentford, for example, or I think he might have gone to Hull as well, if I remember right. But so it was just a series of loans that didn't suit his style. The opportunities dried up for him, and it kind of, again, that was a sliding doors moment for Bostock, that the guy who signed him was binned, and his kind of whole development plan was torn up and forgotten about. Again, that was no fault of his own, but he found himself fighting, swimming against the tide for the next, I guess, 3 or 4 years until his contract expired, pretty much.
Yeah, so many times when managers are appointed at football clubs, and you know, they said, well, you know, we want this guy to bring young players through from the youth team. Well, I'm not sure what the exact figures, but the average tenure for a Premier League manager is something like 15 months. You know, and you're not going to bring young players through, because the benefit of that young player coming through is not going to be felt by you. Probably not the guy that follows you. It might be the guy after that. But there seems a sort of inbuilt dichotomy between, you know, what he's said and what he's actually meant when people say, "I want to bring youth players through." A lot of these guys that are covered in the book, you know, fell of this sort of situation. You just mentioned about Harry Redknapp, and you know, Harry Redknapp was brought to do a job, and he did the job. But youth development probably wasn't part of that as it was under Comoli.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the same going back to Stephen Moore as well. The exact same thing. He got his chance under Graham Taylor, somebody who's always believed in giving young British players a chance. And then Taylor was replaced by David O'Leary, who was more along the thinking of bringing in veterans, people he could trust, players who didn't, you know, he needed to come in and get results. And that's the tension at play, that the managers need results. So that it might be all well and good for them to say that they want to bring through youth players, or even for their chairman to ask for that. But what their chairman wants above all is Premier League safety or a position in Europe. And like you said, their tenures on average are so short that they don't get the time to develop players. So, and that was something Stephen Moore actually spoke about, is that I don't blame the managers. They don't have the option more often than not to take the time and take the chance on a young player. It's just the way the game has gone.
Yeah. Sorry, Stu.
No, it's fine. It's. I mean, as always, time runs away with us. But I suppose to ask, you know, Stephen, it's you don't realize you automatically assume when something goes wrong with a young career, you there's almost a tendency to think there must be something wrong with the player. There must be something in them. There's something that's not right. But actually, it can be on the whim of the decision of somebody else. You know, we look at the Van der Meijden example that Ryan just gave us, you know, and there's obviously more, but it's, you know, it's almost not even their fault. They're just the victim of a personality of someone that either they've never met before or hadn't ever intended on meeting within their career, and yet all of a sudden that person has actually dictated whether or not their career is successful.
Yeah, it's all to do with being in the right place at the right time, but how the right place can turn into the wrong place in the blink of an eye. You know, you've got one manager that has one certain football philosophy, and then they're replaced by someone else who's the polar opposite. You know, if you're a player who was caught in that's, you know, swing of change, then, you know, what can you do about that? It is completely out of your hands. And I think that is what you know, sums up football really is for a lot of people, a lot of players, managers, that so much is, you know, the football is all to do with control, yet there is a massive lack of control.
That's a great quote. That is a great quote. Like I say, we're already over the hour. I apologise for that, but I suppose a couple more questions, Ryan, just before we finish. One is there a player whose story you really want to tell but didn't get the opportunity, it wasn't right, he wasn't ready, or they weren't ready? Is there a player out there whose story you would love or think deserves to be told? You can use whatever rationale you want.
Yeah, if I could have picked one to either add to the book or to have kicked it all off with, it would have been Ravel Morrison. He was someone I tried to get for the book, but never got past like the agent level with him. But I have, kind of intriguingly enough, put together a piece for the Blizzard about him through speaking to people who've worked with him, but obviously had no direct access to the player himself. I just find him a really fascinating character with a really interesting story. And somebody who I think is to a large degree very misunderstood. And I think going back to kind of what we spoke about earlier with the Gascoigne and George Best level of ability, I do think he is that level of a genius footballer from judging by what I've spoke about with people who've worked with him, and there are recollections of working with him and his ability. People who've watched him extensively coming through at United, he was, you know, he could have been that level of footballer, but a combination of personal demons, factors beyond his control, societal factors. His story is just a really fascinating one. I really did enjoy having a chance to dig into that for this piece I've got coming up with the Blizzard, but I would certainly love to have been able to speak to him firsthand and interview him for the book. So yeah, if there was one, I mean, there were several, like I said earlier, there was a list of 50 or 60 guys who we've mentioned in this podcast, guys like Freddie Adu, I would love to have spoken to, but if I could pick one, it'd be Ravel Morrison.
I don't want to put you on the spot here in front of X amount of thousands of listeners that we have, but clearly I'm going to. Will there be another book? I know I could have done it when we'd finished recording, but you know, is there potential for a follow up?
There's not any plan for a follow up. I do have other books in the works, but they're not. There's one that's of a youth development theme. But it's not in any way related to this. So yeah, I have some irons in the fire, but as things stand, there's no follow up to the next big thing. But I guess, hey, I guess it was left open enough that there could be a series two at some point. Who knows?
Excellent. You're right. You have absolutely left it open for there to be a second one. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us. Like I say, everybody who's listening, hopefully after an hour of this, they will go out and have a look and purchase the next big thing. It really is, you know, Stephen's right, it is an absolute story of humanity with football just simply as the backdrop. But thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's been a blast. Thanks.
No problem. Gary, as always, thank you very much.
No, I really enjoyed it, and you know, it's great to talk to Ryan, and you know, as you said, and go buy the book because it's a fascinating read, and it covers so many different players from different clubs who could have made it, and for various reasons it didn't happen, but it's a fascinating read. Go out and buy the book.
There you go. And Stephen, as always, thank you very much.
Oh, joy as always, but yeah, great guest and a brilliant book.
Brilliant. So all that's left is for me to say thank you for listening, and please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.